Paul Nitze once said, "I've advised every president since Roosevelt, and all to some extent have sought and taken that advice." Nitze is generally acknowledged as one of the masters of arms negotiations. Perhaps the greatest example of his creativity was his 1982 Walk in the Woods, when Nitze and his Soviet counterpart broke away from the stalemated official arms talks for a secret meeting to discuss possible compromises. Nitze's role in arms diplomacy dates back to the end of World War II, when he was on the U.S. team that assessed the damage in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He advised President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was a key negotiator in the SALT I Treaty, the INF talks, and the START talks. In 1976, he was a founder of the Committee on the Present Danger, whose goal was to warn Americans that there was a growing Soviet threat. At the age of 82, Nitze has written his autobiography. It's called From Hiroshima to Glasnost, at the Center of Decision. I asked Paul Nitze how his negotiating team would prepare before going into arms talks with the Soviets.
In a negotiation, it is important to try to judge what the other side is going to do and how they're going to view things. So that I, in the beginning of the negotiations with the Soviets in 69, when we had our first talks directly on bilateral talks with the Soviets, before those talks began, I created a red team, a team that assumed themselves to be the Soviets, entering into the negotiations and thinking the way the Soviets think, and talking out amongst themselves how they would plan their strategy for the negotiations and how they would react to the various moves that the Americans might take. The upshot was a very good team was created, and they quite correctly foresaw what the Soviets would in fact do during the first negotiating sessions between us, so that this was a very valuable tool.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've said in some negotiations that the Soviets would try to ply the Americans with food and drink in the hopes of getting them to reveal more. How do you know they weren't just being gracious hosts?
Because it became quite evident that that wasn't what they were being. They were trying to drink us under the table, seduce us with attractive women, do all kinds of quite normal things if somebody's using all the dirty tricks in order to come out ahead in a negotiation.
Since they were trying to drink you under the table, did you try to, while they were drinking a lot, get them to reveal things?
Well, that wasn't our style. Our style was just, let's not drink ourselves under the table. Let's not do what they're proposing. So finally, they agreed with that, and we finally gave up altogether. Neither side was really doing much of any drinking. We'd have a friendly sip of one kind or another. But they finally gave up this technique of trying to drink us under the table.
And what period was that technique used?
Well, that was way back at the beginning of the negotiations, 69, 70, 71.
What other dirty tricks did you feel that the Soviets used over the years?
Well, they had very good spy apparatus, you know, to listen in on our conversations. They had very sensitive detectors. They had us surrounded with listening devices. They even had devices which would pick up the vibrations of our voices on the window panes. They had hidden, you know, microphones here, there, and the other place. So it was very difficult to avoid their hearing our conversations.
So if you wanted to have a conversation with someone else from the U.S. negotiating team, you'd have to walk outside?
No, what we would do is to go into what was called a bubble. And a bubble is a plastic room with electric wires going through the plastic, which make it impossible for anybody from the outside to get the vibrations of what's going on inside. So those rooms are really wholly impervious to being for the Soviets to hear what is going on inside this plastic bubble. And that's where you would do all your talking, was in such a bubble.
In the dirty tricks category, in your memoir, you also mentioned the divide and conquer strategy that the Soviets would sometimes use against the Americans. How would that work?
Well, Mr. Semyonov, who was head of the delegation, would sit next to me at dinner and would describe what a marvelous person I was and how he admired Jim Forrestal, who had been my senior partner in Dillon Reed & Company. And then he would hint that he really was somewhat disappointed with Gerard Smith, the head of our delegation. And then he would talk to Gerard and say what a marvelous person Gerard was and he appreciated his devotion to learning how to speak Russian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and really what a cold and dreadful fish I was, that sort of thing.
Well, how did you find out that this was happening? Did you confer with each other?
Yes, Gerard would tell me, and I would tell Gerard what Semyonov was up to. So it didn't really produce much in the way of results, but I'm just illustrating a technique.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever confront him with it, or is that absurd?
Well, I did indirectly, yes.
What did you say?
Well, I was defending Gerard, because I thought very highly of Gerard. So that I don't think he really got very far with this, but he certainly was trying it out for size.
My guest is the United States' preeminent arms negotiator, Paul Nitze, and he's written a memoir called From Hiroshima to Glasnost. Have you trusted the Soviets over the years that you've negotiated with them, and is it possible to negotiate without trust?
It is possible to negotiate. You take positions, and they take their positions, and one takes, one just sees what eventually turns out. One doesn't really have to trust them. One sees whether, if one gets to an agreement, that one can verify whether it's being adhered to or whether it is not. But I think Mr. Reagan, for instance, used to say, negotiate, but verify. I think that was the phrase he used.
And you'd concur?
I concur in that, yes.
I want to ask you about the walk in the woods of 1982 when you went off for a private walk outside with your Soviet counterpart, Yuli Kvitsinsky. Why was it necessary for the two of you to break off from the official negotiations and talk outside of that?
We had kept a record of everything that either they had said or we had said on the various issues which had arisen during the talks up to that time. So we had this issues book, which had in it about five important issues and some 30 or more, 35 lesser important issues. And we thoroughly knew what their position was, every word that they'd said on each one of those issues, and they knew what our position was. So there was complete understanding between the two sides as to what was dividing us. The question at issue was, how do you bring the two sides together? There, if one concedes on an important issue to their position, they will just take that concession and they won't give you anything for it. And that had been our experience for a long period of time. I didn't see how we were going to make any prompt progress without matching off a whole series of concessions on their side with a whole series of concessions on our side to arrive at a package deal in which their concessions would more or less balance ours. It seemed to me that the best way to do that was to have a side negotiation in which Kvitsinsky and I would come up with a package. But in order to come up with such a package that would be balanced, and we would then submit it to our governments to see whether they thought it was balanced, in order to do that, you have to conduct a different kind of a negotiation than was being conducted on the official level where we both were negotiating under instructions from our two governments. Kvitsinsky told me it was important that we make progress promptly because the Soviets were having a big meeting in which they were eventually going to come up with a revision of their position, which would be probably the only one during Brezhnev's health, his lifetime during his health. And if we were going to get anything done, we had to get it done promptly, was his view. And I took seriously what he told me. So I suggested to him that why don't the two of us go off someplace and see whether the two of us can arrive at a package of concessions by the two sides. And at first, Kvitsinsky was leery of it, but then he decided, well, let's try it.
How well did you know Kvitsinsky's character? Did you feel that you could trust him in asking him to participate in this unofficial negotiation?
Well, my view is to take on face value what the other side tells you until you know, have good evidence that it's wrong and that it is fraudulent. And with respect to Kvitsinsky, I thought I'd finally developed a certain skill in knowing where he was talking, really where you could believe in it, and where he was talking under instructions, where It was just a facade. So that I had some, you have to take a chance, you know, you have to make up your own mind whether it is for real or whether it isn't. But we finally did get to an agreed piece of paper, but he wasn't at all sure that he could persuade his seniors in Moscow to agree to that. And he said that he didn't want me to do anything until I heard further from him, that he'd talked to his superiors and that our ideas had fallen on fertile ground. And if so, he would let me know through a designated man in the Soviet embassy. But he never did let me know through the embassy. And 7 weeks went by before the negotiations resumed, at which time he told me that right away when he'd gotten back to Moscow, it had been made clear that the internal Soviet discussions had already taken place that he'd warned me were going to take place, and that they had decided quite vigorously against the ideas we had developed in our talks. But he'd also been instructed not to let me know anything. So that by the time 3 or 4 weeks had passed without hearing anything from the Soviet embassy, I was quite convinced that he hadn't had any fortune in discussing this with his superiors. And so I rather abandoned any hope that the piece of paper was really going to float. And then later I ran into real objection on our side. So it never came to pass. But if it had come to pass, I still believe it would have been a very good deal for us and a very good deal for the Soviets, and a lot of pain and agony would have been avoided if that had been approved by both sides.
When you were organizing this walk in the woods with your Soviet counterpart, were you afraid that someone else from the United States would find out that you were doing it? Were you very secretive while you were working out the details of where you'd meet and how you were going to get there?
I was secretive only about one thing, and that was after the walk in the woods, I was secretive about the degree to which we'd come to agreement on a common piece of paper. I told everybody on my team exactly what I'd come in with in the way of negotiation, in the way of negotiating positions. But I didn't tell them the degree of success that I'd had. I wanted to keep that secret until I could get back to Washington and describe it first to the president.
How were you reprimanded by the United States?
I wasn't really reprimanded, no.
You weren't?
No.
Were there a few people within the administration who thought that it was a real bad move for you to have held these unofficial negotiations?
Oh, there were. But I wasn't reprimanded by the president or the secretary of state.
Mm-hmm.
No, they understood perfectly well what I was trying to do. But this is true of almost any important negotiation. Mr. Schultz, for instance, you know, is an old negotiator, and he thoroughly recognized that in an important negotiation where you finally got into a mutual standoff where you're not making any progress, it is necessary to find some device and to get around the formalities of the negotiation and see whether someone can't come up through a different channel some potential solution which will get the negotiations going again.
Even though your walk in the woods, even though the agreements that you reach in the walk in the woods never came to pass, do you feel that the walk itself created a valuable precedent for future arms negotiations?
Not really. But I'm sure the fact that we tried to, that somebody on behalf of the United States tried to find a solution to that problem within the time period when it really would have been helpful if we had done so, this was very helpful to us later in our relations with the Europeans, particularly the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Paul Nitze is my guest. You write in your memoir from Hiroshima to Glasnost a little bit about some of the presidents who you've worked with. One of the things you say about Richard Nixon is that he was terribly secretive, so secretive that he'd even use Soviet translators so that the American negotiators wouldn't have access to what he was saying, or something like that. Maybe you can explain a little better.
No, he said exactly that. The problem with Mr. Nixon was that he was... He didn't want to keep things secret from the Russians, because after all, they were on the other side of the table in his discussions with him. He wanted to keep these things secret from the Americans, because he was really deceiving the Americans as to what he was doing. He was building up his negotiations with the Soviets as being the great justification for his continuing to be president, when many of the Americans, in particular people in the Congress, thought he should be impeached. And his defense against impeachment really was, I'm so important to the United States in my relations with the Soviets that you shouldn't impeach me, because I'm the one person who can continue to negotiate in a worthwhile way with the Soviets. So this was his defense against impeachment. And so it's quite obvious that he didn't want the Americans to know too much of what was really going on in the negotiations.
So did he keep a lot of information from you?
He did indeed. From all of us negotiators.
And how did you confront him on that?
Well, I finally found out from my Soviet counterparts about the negotiations he was having with them at a higher level, because on the Soviet side, they kept their negotiators better informed as to what was going on at higher levels than did Nixon keep us, Nixon Henry Kissinger.
So when is the right time to go public about something like this?
Oh, that's a tricky and difficult question to answer. We did tell the Congress, particularly the Senate, about some of these instances in which we'd been kept in the dark, and I believe the Senate had been misled. But that occurred in testimony before the Senate, when you're under oath to speak correctly and honestly. And those hearings were in turn classified, so they did not immediately leak to the press.
Let's talk about President Reagan for a moment. Now, Strobe Talbot, who wrote a biography of you, it's actually focusing on your work in some specific arms negotiations, he refers to what he calls as President Reagan's stunning ignorance about the nuclear weapons over which he had control. When Reagan was president, did you feel that way about him? Did you feel that he was one of the least knowledgeable of American presidents of how nuclear arms worked and what they really meant?
It's impossible for a president to be fully informed on the details of all the issues that he has to deal with. Basically, he has to rely upon his principal advisors for that. I did think that Mr. Reagan was perhaps less knowledgeable about the details of these nuclear weapons than some of the other presidents have been. But that I don't find necessarily something to condemn. He would sometimes tend to make an error in those details, but Shultz would correct him on them, and so we never really got into any trouble on it.
You write in your memoir that you were quite surprised when President Reagan made his first Star Wars address. Did you not know that he was going to recommend the development and the funding of SDI?
I did not know that, no. And not only did I know nothing about it, but even Mr. Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, he knew nothing about it. And I don't think Mr. Shultz knew anything about it. So this was something that the president did with Bud McFarland and the president's scientific advisor and one or two others. But this was not really discussed with anybody at a high level in the U.S. government.
If he had discussed it with you before going public about it, what would you have said to him?
I would have said that there's no solid evidence either that such a system can be developed or that it can't. There's an awful lot of work that has to be done before one can really have a firm judgment as to whether it can meet the criteria that it should be attained before you could possibly be justified in deploying such a system.
So your strategy became to basically use Star Wars as a bargaining chip in negotiations with the Soviets.
It's after having studied carefully all the results of the scientific experiments that had been made to date. I didn't really change that my basic view that it hadn't been proven whether or not this could be done. Either way, it wasn't clear that it couldn't be done. It wasn't clear that you could do it. But I was clear on one thing, and that is you couldn't possibly do it within 10 years in any meaningful way. So that it seemed to me to be perfectly proper to agree to postpone any deployment of such a system for at least 10 years and see whether you could get something worthwhile from the Soviets for such a postponement.
I think it's fair to say that your negotiating strategy over the years has been based on the belief that the Soviets really wanted nuclear superiority, not parity. And I'm wondering if you think that Glasnost has changed that in any fundamental way.
Certainly, Mr. Gorbachev says so, but I still don't believe it's for real, necessarily. So that I still think it's up to us to maintain a capability which would be sufficient to deter anybody who might wish to use those 40,000 or more big nuclear weapons that exist on Soviet territory today, use them in a way antagonistic to the rest of the world.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be interrogated by you.